Like to call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:35 p.m. on Tuesday, April 11th. I'm sorry, Thursday, April 11th. Just want to go back in time here. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Geisel, Senator Dunbar, Vice Chair Hoffman, Senator Tobin, and myself, Senator Wilson. We have a full complement and a quorum to conduct business today. We have four items on the agenda today. We have HCR 15, Mental Health Month, Tardive Dyskinesia Week by the House Health and Social Services Committee, and presented the Department Behavioral Roadmap for Alaskan Youth. And we also have HB 371, Medical Review Organizations by Representative Ruffridge. And under bills previously scheduled and heard, we have HB 89, Daycare Assistance Child Care Grant Program by Rhett Kalum. And we will start off with HCR 15, Mental Health Month, Tardive Dyskinesia Week. And here to present the bill on behalf of Representative Prox is Maggie Ellett. You want to come on to the front, put yourself on the record, and you may begin when you're ready. And also on the phone is Ann Ringstag with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is also on the phone for committee members' questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, I'm Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Prox. In Alaska, as across the nation, mental illness and its negative impacts stretch far and wide, touching families in every community and across all walks of life. HCR 15 shines a light on the importance of mental health awareness and the challenges of tardive dyskinesia. It is estimated that over 108,000 adults in the state have mental health conditions such as major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and other debilitating behavioral health conditions. The onset of mental health disorders peaks during adolescence and early adulthood, marking a critical period for intervention and support. Yet many Alaskans do not receive the treatment they need due to a variety of barriers, including cost and access to professionals. Complicating the landscape is the prevalence of tardive dyskinesia, a movement disorder induced by long-term use of antipsychotic medications. Tardive dyskinesia affects 10 to 30% of individuals taking these medications and can significantly impact their quality of life. HCR 15 will designate May 2024 as Mental Health Awareness Month and May 5th through 11th as Tardive Dyskinesia Awareness Week. By doing this, we support those battling mental health conditions, advocate for comprehensive care, and challenge the stigma that discourages seeking help. Let us make mental health a priority in Alaska, ensuring that our policies, resources, and communities are aligned in support of those who face these challenges every day. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for the sponsor of this SCR 15? Yes, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is every May 5th through 11th Awareness Week? Or is this specific to only this upcoming week in May?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, it's just specific to this month of May, and then we hope to bring it to the body every session. That way it brings more awareness to mental health.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we'll open up to public testimony. Is anyone here in the room would like to testify to SCR 15? All right, seeing no one and seeing no one online, we will go ahead and close public testimony. As for all items of public testimony, if anyone would like to send any written comments, they can to the Senate Health Committee at shss@akleg.gov. Are there final questions for the bill sponsor? Does the bill sponsor have any closing remarks?
No, I'd just like to thank you for hearing this House concurrent resolution. Thank you.
At this time, we'll set an amendment deadline for April 16th at noon. Please let our office know if you have any amendments to SCR 15 by that time. We will take a brief at ease as we transition to the next presentation. And thank you again. We are back on the record. Our next, we'll have a presentation on the Behavioral Health Roadmap for Alaska Youth by the Department of Health. Here to brief the committee this afternoon is Leah Van Kirk, the Health Care Policy Advisor from the Department of Health. And we have Director Tracy Doppling from the Division of Behavioral Health. And also in the room is Deputy Director Clinton Lasley from the Department of Family and Community Services. Director and Health Care Policy Advisor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Wilson, members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. My name is Tracy Dompling for the record. I am the director for the Division of Behavioral Health. Also presenting with me today is Leah Van Kirk, the Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health's Commissioner's Office. We want to thank you for this opportunity today to provide an overview of the Alaska's Behavioral Health Roadmap for Alaska Youth. In partnership with the Department of Family and Community Services, the roadmap project was an opportunity to speak to Alaskans, to speak to stakeholders, community members, and individuals who are family members, actually, who have children who are trying to navigate through the behavioral health care system. Our presentation today will identify the risk factors and the behavioral health needs of Alaska's youth that led to this important work, the framework for the roadmap project itself, insight into the regional work that was performed, and then also how this work is shaping existing activities that are occurring within the behavioral health system, as well as helping us to prioritize future activities within behavioral health.
Good afternoon. For the record, Leah Van Kirk. So I want to start by taking a moment to share what youth are experiencing in Alaska to frame the importance of why we're doing this work. So we know that Alaska has some of the highest rates of suicide in the nation, consistently twice the national average. We also know that specifically for youth, suicide continues to be the leading cause of death. And we see high numbers of high school youth reporting attempting suicide. We also have our hospital emergency department data showing that even younger youth between the ages of 11 and 14 are seeing increasing visits to the emergency room for behavioral health issues. We also know that in adolescence and early adulthood, it marks the age where we often see the first time onset of mental health issues, and that youth and families are for the first time navigating a system that they're unfamiliar with and extremely challenged by. We see also through our health facilities data reporting that our leading causes of hospitalization for youth ages 15 through 24 are related to depressive disorders, suicidality, bipolar, and related disorders. But I want to highlight some other things as well. So even though we have seen increases in our suicide attempts, suicide has remained the leading cause of death for Alaska's youth. In 2022, we actually saw a decrease in our overall suicide rate, and that was consistent for youth as well. And I think that's important. This work is hard. Sometimes it feels hopeless because it's hard to decrease the number of youth who we're seeing have these negative behavioral health outcomes. And this is important because we want to create a system that can respond to what youth are experiencing, a system that intervenes earlier and provides the care and support youth and families need in order to prevent these negative outcomes. I also want to emphasize that this is not only an Alaska issue. On a national level, youth and young adults are struggling with behavioral health. And in 2021, our U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory to highlight the urgent need to address the national youth mental health crisis. So as we initiated the behavioral health roadmap work, there were many background initiatives and assessments that contributed to the direction in which we took. There's a significant amount of targeted work across the state that will help us learn how we can better build systems of support that targets youth. And I specifically want to identify the Department of Education, the Department of Family and Community Services, as well as the Department of Health,
our Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association engaged in some of these comprehensive reports to look at behavioral health offered in schools, to look at our hospital system, our inpatient residential systems, and then together our departments developed an overview of the behavioral health system that's available for children. In utilizing these reports, one of the things we recognized was that there are regional characteristics and gaps and challenges. And so it was important to hear from stakeholders and community members within those regions to help inform our next steps moving forward.
For the record, Tracy Dompling. We wanted to provide an overview of the how the input was gathered, the important input was gathered for this process, because we wanted to make sure that the information was informed by stakeholders all across Alaska. And I know I mentioned before, but including tribes, service providers, communities, and again, really that importance of hearing from families who have children who are trying to navigate the behavioral health system and have some of those unmet behavioral health needs. We also wanted to ensure that there was more opportunity for participation other than just the in-person meetings, which then led us to having opportunities for virtual attendance at the meetings. The work of the roadmap initiated with the steering committee, which really was there to help provide guidance and then to act in that advisory capacity for the work moving forward. We had representation from the folks that are listed here. A lot of those folks were actually individuals or organizations that had been either authoring some of the reports that Ms. Van Kirk had mentioned previously, or were also working on some of the initiatives that had come from those reports. The state agencies that participated were the Departments of Health, Family and Community Services, and Education and Early Development. Wanted to take a minute to recognize Senator Wilson, as well as Representative Colomb, who both graciously agreed to participate and be members of the steering committee for this effort. We also had tribal health organizations, the Alaska Native Health Board, Alaska Tribal Health Consortium. There were also tribal child welfare organizations. Alaska Mental Health Authority was represented. And we also had advocacy associations that were representing youth service or youth serving organizations in behavioral health, in developmental disabilities, excuse me, healthcare organizations, and also primary healthcare organizations.
For the record, Leah Van Kirk. So during the latter part of 2022, we held 5 regional events. You can see in different communities across Alaska. We wanted to have events in a variety of different places, some smaller, some larger. And throughout our engagement, we wanted to make sure that we allowed for recognition of regional and cultural differences to help us understand what the regional gaps in services are, what the regional needs were, and then also what is effective and what is working in each of these communities. It was important that we empowered individual communities and regions to be the authors and owners of how they're going to approach this work and serve their youth best. There were many people who participated. You can see the number of attendees for each regional event, and that was a compilation of behavioral health providers or organizations providing behavioral health care. Many local supports that included schools, after-school programs, advocates, coalitions, prevention, early intervention programs, as well as many departments from the state of Alaska, so including schools, school counselors, administrators, courts, child protection, juvenile justice, law enforcement, and we had large representation from our tribal health communities. So not only did our tribal partners comprise the steering team, but we also had our tribal behavioral health directors help plan and organize each event, making sure that we represented tribal voice in all of the meetings across the state. We also utilized a facilitator that was neutral, so that as we went to each community, that it wasn't communities speaking to a state entity. And that, I think, helped facilitate, I think, neutral and honest dialogue about what gaps are in the systems and how we can develop solutions to address those gaps, because they don't all lie within state-offered or state-funded services. So it was really exciting to hear communities work together to talk about solutions that would be effective for them. Each event was a two-day event, and we spent time inventorying the resources in that region, as well as identifying gaps, and then coming to a place where we generated and prioritized regionally based solutions, and that culminated with action planning. So it wasn't just to listen and hear about gaps, but really develop solutions and how we can take steps forward to take action. A key component of each one of these meetings was an evening community listening session, and that was meant to engage families, youth, or young adults who are experiencing or had experienced the behavioral health system and how that impacted them and their families. Statewide, we saw some really similar themes, some of those being the difficulty in accessing care, also the emotional and financial impacts to a family when a child is experiencing the behavioral health system and the challenges related to that. We also shared resources that were effective, that worked. And we also heard, I think consistently across the state, just difficulties in navigation. It's a hard system to navigate, even for people who work within the behavioral health field.
Before you go on, might want to mention that there was actually a sixth meeting for sort of the off-net. If you missed one of the community meetings or couldn't attend the statewide, there was an off-net meeting also for folks to attend as well.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. You bring up a great point, which we did offer virtual attendance for the in-person meetings as well as that sixth virtual meeting. Thank you.
For the record, Tracy Dompling. So our regional events actually engaged attendees in five areas across the crisis, or excuse me, across the continuum of care. So going anywhere from the prevention and early intervention to step down services from residential care. So over those 2 days, there was a lot of focus in those areas, but eventually the ask of participants was to choose one of these five areas that is important to them, to their organization, to their community, to the region, to take a bit of a deeper dive, to not just look at, you know, what are the existing services and what are the gaps, but what are some solutions to identifying or to solving those gaps? And then who are the other partners that might be participants in that process, either for a community or for a region? We received a lot of feedback from participants as well. You know, during the pandemic, as we know, there was not a lot of in-person opportunities. And these meetings created in-person opportunities where people were saying they had never even had an opportunity to meet face-to-face with some of the people and the work that they do. And so they also were able to learn about some of, you know, additional services that they may not have known about in their communities. But as we were talking about the continuum of care and listening throughout this process, there were three real areas that we call cross-cutting areas that were continuing to be a focus, which was data, the care coordination, and Ms. Van Kirk spoke about that earlier, as well as provider support. The community engagement really gave us the opportunity to not just go and look at what are the gaps and what are existing services, but really being able to have a report that identified what are some actionable items moving forward that are meaningful to communities throughout Alaska. So the work culminated really with 47 individual recommendations that cut across this continuum of care and also these cross-cutting areas. So next, we're going to highlight just some of them. We're not going to go through all 47, because 47 are listed in the report, but we just wanted to highlight some of them that came into each of these sections here.
For the record, Leah Van Kirk. So I'll start us off with a few of the recommendations related to prevention and early intervention. And I think one theme that we heard in every region and every meeting was the importance of not forgetting about prevention and early intervention. That when we engage in prevention, we have the best long-term impact. And so that as we talk about all the other parts of the continuum of care, that we make sure that we have recommendations that are supporting prevention and early intervention. So one of the recommendations that came through also in each meeting was providing supports in schools, and even more specifically, increasing access to school-based Medicaid services. We know that children are at school. That's the place where they go every day, and so it's a natural environment for them to receive services. There were two recommendations, actually. It was supporting mental health in schools, but then also being more specific about the school-based Medicaid component and increasing access. And so I just also want to thank the committee. You've seen some of the work we've started, and so for your support for SB 240.
For the record, Tracy Dompling, in the area of outpatient supports, there was this resounding theme from providers about their financial difficulties that directly tied into claims processing. So we were able to share that, and I know this committee has heard as well, but that the Division of Behavioral Health is ending out its contract with our existing administrative services organization at the end of this year, and will be transitioning claims processing into the Medicaid Management Information System. So through that, we hope that providers will, it will ease providers that they have one location to submit their claims, that they also, you know, we want to see that improve timeliness and accuracy of payments, and ultimately being able to help providers be financially sustainable, sustaining the existing services that they have. And we've definitely heard that providers want to be able to expand that service continuum, but there is a bit of a fear in doing so, knowing that, you know, there's this questionable, you know, how, when are we going to get paid, and are we going to get paid accurately? And so this is part of what we need in our overall service continuum.
And I just wanted to note for folks listening online, following, we're talking about getting rid of Optum and going to ourselves. You should just name it. It's fine to name it so that providers know what the issue was.
Thank you. In the area of crisis and subacute care, we heard a lot of comments about wanting to improve the overall crisis continuum of services, and also looking at expanding mobile crisis teams and bolstering that 23-hour crisis stabilization and also the crisis residential programs. So we've been able to leverage at Behavioral Health an existing contractor, Milliman, who has been doing work with us to look at how can we create a more robust crisis care continuum within the state of Alaska. So they've had an opportunity to look at claims processing from both the 1115 waiver as well as state plan services. There has been a lot of stakeholder engagement with tribes. They have met with providers who are currently providing 23-hour and crisis residential, as well as met with providers who are in the process of standing up those services and building out facilities, and also meeting with our behavioral health organizations to get input, as well as, you know, what has already been done and kind of researched in the area of the crisis work. So ultimately, the goal there is that we can create flexibilities so that smaller communities and smaller providers, even rural communities, have that flexibility to create crisis services that work in their communities, so that we can have individuals remaining closer to home, especially when it comes to children, so that they can remain close to home, they can remain close to their families, and those important support networks throughout that process. For residential and inpatient services, one of the areas we've been focusing on is a collaboration with the Department of Family and Community Services, looking at expanding the use of therapeutic treatment homes. So we're looking at, you know, what are licensing criteria, what are, you know, claims criteria for those types of homes, and looking at how we can expand on them so that we are creating more opportunities for children, youth, to be able to remain in communities and, again, close to home where they can receive those services and be with their supports.
For the record, Leah Van Kirk. One of the areas that we identified on the continuum was the importance of step-down services And specifically, a recommendation was focusing on improving services with individuals with complex needs. And so in partnership, the division of, or the Department of Family and Community Services and the Department of Health have formed a complex care committee. And that committee focuses on providing solutions and addressing system gaps for access to care for patients with complex needs. There's also, there's three tiers to the work that we're doing around complex care. The second is that individual review. So when we have someone whose needs are not being met, or we can't find a level of care that's going to meet their needs or ability to step down, it's our departments coming together and staffing that particular person's needs in order to find solutions, looking at systems and how we can make systems meet the needs of people who are experiencing those additional needs. The third component of that is going to be then engaging care coordination and providers through a complex care coalition, and that is in the works, and so we look forward to the continued work in this particular area. One of the other areas that we focused on and that we recognized as part of this work is that there were cross-cutting themes to the continuum. We identified those as data, care coordination and navigation, and provider supports. And all three of those things showed up as needs that could enhance the continuum and how we provide those services. So a few of the recommendations that focused on data were to identify and utilize the data from our emergency departments around youth who are frequently showing up in the emergency room with a behavioral health related concern, a suicidal ideation, an attempt, or self-harm, and using data to recognize this person has visited three times. And so then using that to inform next steps to develop supports around that youth and that family. That kind of leads us into a recommendation around care coordination and navigation. And I can't say how much this is an important part of our work moving forward. The behavioral health system is difficult and challenging. All of the work that we've done and the reports that we talked about earlier, as well as what we heard from communities, centers on this as a key aspect of how we move forward. And so one of the ways in which we would utilize the data that I talked about before would be then to assign or develop care coordination for those identified youth or young adults to make sure that they get connected with the services that they need in order to prevent a higher level of care when we don't respond appropriately or when we don't respond and connect people to the services that they need. Another area that was identified was provider support. We had many providers attend these meetings, and so across the state, we had providers articulating what their needs were in order to do their best work. And I have to say, Alaskans are very focused on supporting youth. People come to the table, and they want to make systems better. So this process was very valuable. What we heard was that we want to develop a larger capacity to support behavioral health providers. And so the Division of Behavioral Health will be procuring a behavioral health organization contract to provide just that, increased opportunities for training for providers who are already providing services, but then also to support providers who want to add additional services or new providers who are figuring out how to deliver services that are needed regionally and statewide. And that will help us really look at our regional capacity as well, knowing we have gaps in this particular area. How can we provide support to behavioral health providers in this region to make sure we're meeting the needs of the characteristics that are needed in that region?
Before you go on to that, under care coordination, my understanding is that a while ago, the department used to have a platform that all the licensed RCCY providers would have their own sort of website link and log in to update their daily bed census. Is that no longer the case, or did something change in that process?
To the chair, so historically, the Division of Public Health had a contract that allowed for providers to enter their bed registry information or their bed utilization. That there was another RFP that went out, and so they're in the process of finalizing who would offer that bed registry service. So that is something that the department identifies as important so that providers can provide that information. It's an access point for referrals as well.
I guess to follow up to that, so are we currently still doing that, or is that on pause? So today, is there a website or a link to see the bed utilization and the number of beds available across the state? Or is that... I'm hearing the answer is being yes, being whispered behind your lifeline. Please continue, unless there's further questions.
Okay. For the record, Leah Van Kirk. So really, this work was about making sure that we are charting our path forward in an informed way, understanding what our background assessments and the work that we've done that informs gaps in our systems, not only from providers, but from tribal health, from stakeholders, from parents who are navigating the system, to state departments. And so we're excited that the Behavioral Health Roadmap for Alaska Youth will be published on May 1st and look forward to the work in front of us to truly make a difference in creating and developing a system that meets the needs of our youth.
Thank you for presenting. And are there questions for the committee? Seeing none, if not, we will follow up with your wonderful ledge liaison, Ms. Courtney Enright. We'll take a brief at ease as we get ready to go to House Bill 371. We are back on the record. We are now at HB 371, Medical Review Organizations, by Representative Ruffridge. This is our first time hearing the bill. Our intent is to hear the bill, take invited public testimony, and put the bill aside for further consideration. Before us today, we have his trustee staff members, Mr. Bud Sexton and Sabrina Braun. So you guys want to place yourselves on the record, and you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Bud Sexton. I am staff to Representative Ruffridge.
And for the record, Sabina Braun, staff to Representative Ruffridge.
Representative Ruffridge apologizes for not being able to be here. He's on the floor currently and kind of an important vote that they have upcoming. So sends his apologies. Thank you for the opportunity to come and address you today regarding House Bill 371, Medical Review Organizations. So it's a very brief sponsor statement as well as presentation, but always happy to entertain any questions you have. In addition, we have Department of Health that is here to be able to help answer specific questions that you may have. So House Bill 371 deals with medical review organizations, and very broadly speaking, the goal of these organizations is to take data and information And the goal ultimately is to reduce or prevent injuries, illnesses, or deaths. So they can cover a wide variety of issues and topics. And so this bill would make some minor modifications to that. One of them is to talk about healthcare providers. Currently, as we all know, when you make specific lists of physicians in statute, there can be challenges from future years as different positions can be modified or added or removed. Also, this bill seeks to modify who can approve members of medical review organizations. It's taken from the state medical board and to move it more closely aligned with Department of Health and the chief medical officer for that. The membership currently has to be comprised of 75% of healthcare providers. And as we know, and the staff will be able to give a few more examples of how that could be greatly enhanced in review process with some modifications for that. And so very briefly, that's what this bill is about. And with your permission, we turn it over to Ms. Braun to be able to give a brief presentation.
Please, Ms. Braun.
Yes, thank you through the chair. For the record, Sabina Braun, Staff Representative Ruffridge. Thank you again for hearing HB 371 relating to medical review organizations. So as Bud said, medical review organizations exist to provide reports on death and illness and injury and hopefully reduce those in the future. And they do this by gathering data from clinical reports, and that's how they provide their reports. And various healthcare organizations can establish these. There's a list here. It includes hospitals, clinics, the state medical board, and the commissioner of health are among those. So Alaska currently has three medical review organizations. As you can see here, the Maternal Child Death Review Committee, the Overdose Fatality Review Committee, and the Congenital Syphilis Review Committee. So the intent behind HB 371 is just to streamline this process and make medical review organizations more effective and, you know, with the high goal of reducing avoidable death and injury among Alaskans. So current statute is fairly vague on whether or not medical review organizations can even publish their reports, which obviously greatly inhibits their main goal. Also in current statute, the definition of healthcare provider is very specific. And as Bud said, we all know it's very hard to go in and change statute, and healthcare is always changing. So this is just limits healthcare organizations. Current statute also requires that the Alaska State Medical Board approve medical review organizations. And there's also a current requirement that 75% of the membership of medical review organizations be made up of healthcare providers. And current statute also only allows for one accrediting organization to accredit these, and there's currently six in the nation. So with the implementation of HB 371, we would provide specific language so medical review organizations can provide their reports as long as that's not going to be breaking any confidentiality laws. This bill is also going to remove the current list of healthcare providers, as I said before, just to allow more flexibility for the changing healthcare field. This is also going to delete the current requirement that 75% of the board be made up of healthcare providers. One instance that I like to give is on the opioid review committee. It can be so helpful to have maybe a state trooper or first responders on this board who might not necessarily be healthcare providers, but can provide a lot of data that's very helpful to reduce death and illness and injury. We're also going to change the approval of members to these committees from the state medical board to the chief medical officer. That keeps it within the Department of Health and just streamlines the process a bit. It'll also be broadening who can establish these review organizations and accredit them. As I said before, there are six in the nation. Current statute only has the name of one specific one. So this is just going to broaden this and give them a little more flexibility.
I just want to go back there just to clarify, because I just want to make sure this bill is removing the current list of healthcare providers, which is a narrow list, and is replacing it with this language on page two Line 17, a person licensed, certified, otherwise permitted by law to provide health care services in an ordinary course of business and practice of a profession. I just want to make sure, so there's still healthcare professional or providers, but we're broadening that definition to healthcare providers. I just want to make the public aware of that. We're not just saying it's going to be a bunch of attorneys mm-hmm. or other folks on this committee.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Yes.
All right.
And yeah, we can take any questions, and we also have a sectional if you'd like me to read that.
Yes. Let's go ahead and go to the sectional before we go to committee's questions.
Perfect. All right, so section 1 under AS 18.23.30A is amended to add an exemption to the disclosure of data, and this will be in the next section. Section 2 under AS 18.23.030 is amended to add a new subsection that allows a review organization to establish a report containing data or information acquired in the exercise of its duties, ensuring that the report does not violate federal or state law regarding confidentiality of a person or a decedent. Under Section 3, AS 18.23073 changes the definition of healthcare provider in reference to a review organization to mean a person licensed, certified, or otherwise permitted by law to provide healthcare services in the ordinary course of business or practice of a profession, and removes the list of specific provider types. Under Section 4, AS 18.230705A and B are not modified by HB 371. Under the same statute C, the review organization membership is approved by the chief medical officer in the Department of Health and removes the provision that at least 75% of the committee members must be healthcare providers. And then under D, it allows all nationally recognized groups that accredit healthcare organizations to have review organizations. Current law limits this to the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for the bill sponsor, Senator Tobin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to admit that this is a little bit outside my scope of understanding, so I apologize if my question is inartful. But I'm looking at Section 2, this new section of statute, and I am curious, and it may be a two-part question, is there a review organization currently that evaluates deaths in the Division of Corrections? And would this particular section, if applied to that particular review organization or a future existing review organization, help unpack what may have been or what currently is happening in our Division of Corrections with the significant number of inmate deaths?
Yeah, so through the chair, again, Samina Braun, Staff Representative Ruffridge, to Senator Tobin, there's not currently a medical review organization relating to Department of Health, Department of Corrections deaths. Hopefully opening up this bill will streamline this process and allow for maybe something like that to happen. And I can't speak to specifically to what this bill, how that would affect that, but Director Cotto may be able to add a little bit more to that.
Yes, I see her nodding her head okay. and wishing to chomp at to come to the mic to speak.
Yes.
Director?
Hello, and thank you. For the record, this is Lindsay Cotto, Director for the Division of Public Health. And thank you again for considering House Bill 371. We are very excited, as you could see from the back of my head nodding, about the introduction of this bill. And thank you, Sabina. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, what we are talking about here too is the ability to expand. And so if the Department of Health were to do a Department of Corrections review organization or a partnership, due to the current constraints around statute about having 75% healthcare providers, wouldn't allow us to have a robust of an assessment that we could potentially have, which would include correctional officers that are not healthcare providers, and really expanding who can participate, including folks like reentry coalition members who might, or people with lived experience who might want to participate on a review organization or whose perspective could be very valuable.
Any further questions for the bill sponsor or for our public health director? Seeing none, just want to say thank you. We'll at this time open it up to public testimony.
Is any? Yep, we have one person in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill. I'm sorry, House Bill 371. You know, place yourself on the record and take a couple of minutes and go through your testimony.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Carmen Wenger. I am the Director of Programs and the Acting Executive Director for the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership. I'm pleased to be here today to support HB 371. ATP2 is a statewide nonprofit organization that focuses our efforts on solutions that support the health and wellness of Alaska's children and their families. HB 371 will provide greater opportunities to prevent and reduce avoidable deaths, injuries, and illnesses to help improve Alaska's health, including its mothers and children. This bill provides clarification on the sharing and publication of reports and recommendations based on the findings of medical review organizations or review committees, while still requiring federal and state confidentiality laws to be met. In addition, the removal of the 75% healthcare provider composition requirement represents a shift towards more of an interdisciplinary team model, something that has been a best practice throughout many medical and public health settings. ATP2 supports the passage of HB 371 because we believe it will result in better health, improved policy, and a reduction in preventable deaths, injury, and illness for Alaska's children and families. Thank you for your support of this important legislation.
All right. Thank you, Carmen. There's no questions, but I just want to say thank you for coming in to provide your testimony this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair.
And for folks listening online, again, if you'd like to provide a written testimony to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, you can by sending an email to shss@akleg.gov. Seeing no one else online and anyone else here in the room in Juneau wish to testify on HB 371, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any final comments to the bill sponsor or from the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we will go ahead and set an amendment deadline for April 17th, Wednesday, April 17th at noon. Please let us know if you have amendments that you are willing to offer to HB 371. We'll take a brief at ease as we get to our last item on the agenda, HB 89. Back on the record. Our last up on our agenda is, again, is House Bill 89 by Rhett Kloom. We heard initial hearing and took invited and public testimony on this bill on March 21st. At this time, we understand that Rhett Kloom is busy on other state business, but her staff, Leah Preston, And Ms. Edra Morledge is here and can give us a brief reminder of the subject of this piece of legislation. Also available on phone is Margaret Berger from Alleged Legal, and via Leah Van Kirk, our healthcare policy from the Department of Health, is still here to answer department questions. We'll turn the over to the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, members of the HSS committee. Rep. Kalom apologizes for not being here in person, but the House members are on the floor attending to other business. The sponsor thanks you for taking HB 89 back up today. The bill is a priority for her, so she appreciates the committee hearing it, and she yields to the discretion of the committee on further action. House Bill 89 is a workforce bill that aligns with the Governor's Child Care Task Force on child care recommendations. Just as a brief reminder, the bill will incentivize the private sector to offer child care benefits to their employees to fill jobs essential for economic growth, expands the number of families that can access assistance, and aligns funding to the actual cost of care. The Department of Health is available for how the bill will work in the program, as well as members from legal for any drafting questions the committee might have. Thank you for hearing HB 89 again.
All right. Are there any questions before we go through the amendment process? Seeing none, I will start with the amendment process. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment U.8.
As amendment number one.
As amendment number one.
All right. I object for purposes of conversation. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the amendment before you does a few things, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what they do, but I want to start off with a little bit of understanding of tax credits. So when we give a tax credit, essentially we're saying to a company that would owe us a tax that instead of paying the government agency or the entity that helps supply a system and a structure for them to do business, that they can use that for the public good. Tax credit becomes something they use for the public good. So essentially, it's public dollars. So when I look through this bill and I'm reading through it, I think of another program that I often talk about, which is the Preschool for All model in Multnomah County. In Multnomah County, which is where Portland is concentrated or centered, they have a nominal tax that they voted in. The citizens of Multnomah County voted themselves to be taxed so that they could provide subsidies to child care facilities. In those subsidies, they have specific stipulations or requirements because it's a public dollar that's being used. And some of those stipulations outline how they want to create a system that is accessible to all, to every child, whether they are Black, Brown, Native American, children of all colors, if they speak English, if they do not speak English, if they have developmental delays or disabilities, if they come from families who have limited or low incomes, or if they come from a family that has more affluence, or even if they're experiencing houselessness or homelessness. And in looking at how Multnomah County has structured their program, it really creates this accessibility, this idea that these dollars should be available to everyone. Well, understandably, in this legislation, it's for specific employers or for entities who are taking advantage of these tax credits. You have to have a job. There's some other components with this. And so understanding that if an employer is creating a facility for their employees, I don't necessarily want to take away those slots. So if you look through this particular amendment, you'll see that on page 21, we get to kind of the substance of this, which is to, once you have filled those slots, to give priority, if you have available slots open, to give priority to children from low-income families when fulfilling any available slot. My district has a significant number of children who are unfortunately in that category of low or limited incomes, or sometimes no income. And I want to know and hope that there will be slots available to them. Sometimes their parents are out of work. They're not able to take advantage of the tax subsidy. They're not able to take advantage of the opportunity that this bill would provide. So this is the hope that if a childcare facility receives tax credits and they have available slots, that if they have applicants from a family that might have low to limited income, that they make those slots available to those individuals. The next piece in this particular amendment, starting on line 17 of the amendment, which starts on page 21 of the bill, inserts that section that I mentioned, that when you take public dollars, there are certain stipulations that I think we should all agree to, which is you shouldn't be able to deny a child acceptance into your facility based on the fact that they might have a disability or they have low or even high socioeconomic status. And also that you cannot suspend or expel that child. That is one of the key stipulations in the Multnomah Preschool for All model, is that we've seen that certain young people are expelled at higher rates, and that we've seen that certain young folk are suspended at higher rates, creating more instability for that family. So within this particular thing, if you're taking public dollars and using them to establish your facility or maintain your facility, I think we should have some requirements, which is that you are not able to expel or suspend a child for these reasons, for any reason, really. So that is the amendment that I put before you, and I'm happy and robust. I'm happy to entertain any conversation or dialogue about it.
Thank you. We'll go to Senator Geisel first.
Senator Tobin, my concern is that these facilities will not be able to expel or suspend a child who's harming others. That's deeply concerning to me, and I just wouldn't be able to agree with that.
I'm happy to consider an amendment to the amendment.
Let's take a brief at ease here. We're back on the record. Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, I would offer an amendment to this amendment, and that would be this is amendment U.8, line 21. I propose that we strike that entire line that states or suspend or expel a child from the facility.
All right. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment to the amendment passes. Which brings us back to amendment number one, U.8, as amended. Is there further conversation? I don't have an amendment or a fix for this item, and I'll hopefully see this in the next committee referral, but it's to give a priority to low-income families when filling the available facilities. I just want to make sure that we are referencing a definition of low-income families. Is that just... And I'm not sure if that's in this amendment, or are we going to reference a definition later on in the bill that should be referenced when making that. But we can work on that as the item, and I can work with the bill sponsor and the maker of the amendment as we continue this process. But that is my only concern upon this amendment as amended. Is there further discussion? I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number one? As amended. Seeing none, amendment number one as amendment passes, which brings us to amendment number two, which is my amendment. I will move amendment number two, U.9, and ask the health policy advisor, but let me first move amendment number two.
Object for purpose of discussion.
Thank you. And we'll ask Ms. Van Kirk to come on up. And this is on page 19, line 2, following size, unless the family is exempted from income eligibility requirements. And I'll let Ms. Van Kirk explain this amendment.
Thank you. For the record, Leah Van Kirk, Department of Health. So this amendment focuses on ensuring that the current system is allocated for related to these changes. So this change of changing the state median income to 105% is noted here in such a way that all families must meet that income eligibility. And we currently have federally approved families who meet the eligibility requirements because the child is in foster care or because they're on public benefits. And so their eligibility is determined by those things. So this line is meant to allow for any other eligibility criteria that is federally regulated and currently in practice.
Are there any questions? Senator Kaufman?
I remove my objection.
Is there further objection from amendment number two, U.9? Seeing none, that amendment passes, which brings us to amendment number three, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number three.
I'll object. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So amendment number three incorporates some of the conversations that we've been having at the Child Care Task Force around this concept or definition of quality. We often hear our child care providers and our representatives in the Department of Health say that they want to ensure we have quality child care facilities. And in looking through the statute and trying to understand through regulation what is it that we have quantified as quality is still a little bit in discussion. It's being developed right now in regulation. It was actually the topic of conversation we had this week at the task force meeting. And so this amendment would ensure that any facility that receives these subsidies, any facility that receives these funds, would need to be designated as a quality child care facility by the department. As you can see within the amendment, I'm not trying to stipulate what quality is. I believe that the department currently is working with stakeholders to ensure that that definition is rooted in their lived experience, their expertise, and their knowledge of what creates a quality child care facility. So here on amendment three, you'll see that starting on line five of the amendment, which is page 20 of the bill, we insert that to receive these subsidies, you must be designated as a quality child care facility by the department, just ensuring we lift that level of standard, that level of expectation for these facilities, and work with them so that they can meet this definition of quality, which I believe much comes from technical assistance. And then there, starting on page 9 of the amendment, which is page 21 of the bill, we insert a subsection that says that definition of quality is one that will be developed with child care resource and referral agency and state consultation. So again, it's not the department coming up with this definition. It's one that's currently been being worked on right now with the child care task force. But I do just want to reiterate that as we use tax credits, which are again public funds, that we're making sure that we lift the tide in expectations. We ensure that the entities that are receiving our resources meet our standards and stipulations of quality. So that is what the amendment seeks to do. I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has them.
And I know that the bill sponsor may have had a couple of questions or statements. And
yes, can I call my lifeline up from the Department of Health?
Yes.
As well. Just to start with, though, yes, for the record, Aaliyah Preston, staff to Representative Julie Colom. For the record, this particular amendment is probably needed, is probably desired for all of, we want children to have the best childcare possible experience. The concern could be that we're adding regulations to something when we're already in a childcare desert in very many of our municipalities. And so that was the Representative Colom's hesitance about this, that it would cause more regulations than what was needed. And yesterday in the Child Care Task Force, I heard Ms. Van Kirk talk about how this would be the regulations that we're wanting to encourage people, and I'll let her say it because she said it better, that it was as an added, but I'll let her say that so she can say it right.
Ms. Van Kirk.
All right. For the record, Leah Van Kirk.
Thank you.
For the record, Leah Van Kirk, to the chair. So yesterday, we had our in-person Governor's Task Force meeting. Thank you, Senator Tobin, for your service on the Governor's Task Force. We had a robust conversation about quality and how to ensure that that becomes a part of our licensing process, an expectation that we communicate to people providing service to our youngest, most vulnerable children. The child care grant, which is where this is being added right now, is provided to providers who are licensed or approved, and it's based on attendance of children. So right now, there's the base indicator of quality, which is that they're a licensed facility or they meet those approval standards. And if you listen to kind of the base one of quality programs, it's defined that a program is licensed. In addition to that, in 2016, the department developed Learn and Grow, which is a quality recognition and improvement system that has standards built into it. Different from accreditation, the Learn and Grow system provides coaching and interactive cohorts to help support childcare providers. It also provides incentives based on the levels in which providers have attained. And so, as we discussed quality at the Child Care Task Force meeting yesterday, one of the things that we heard is we want to make sure that we don't take away something that's providing support to current providers that they rely on. The child care grant is very small for some providers. There's a $50 cap per child. And so the recommendations of the task force talked about, let's maintain that initial level. Our recommendation would be to maintain the initial level, which is the formula in which providers are receiving that grant now, but then build out incentives to engage in quality and the Learn and Grow system. So on top of that, be eligible for additional grant funding if they meet that level one criteria of the Learn and Grow system that's delivered by THRED.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try not to go too far afield here, but I think it relates to the issues I have as well. And at least so far in the discussion, I'm supportive of this amendment because I think it touches on some of the issues I'm curious about. But I had a meeting a couple of days ago with some child care providers who were in dire straits and needed additional funding. And so they were encouraging Amendment 90, which I think was on the floor yesterday, to significantly increase this amount. Did it pass? I apologize. There's so many here. So did not pass. So that's unfortunate. So we had an opportunity to directly do the funding you're describing. And at least so far, it hasn't been able to pass, which is I think concerning. I am curious also about the pass through money, the $50 per child. What is the fund source for that? Is it a federal pass through? Is it state general fund dollars? Do you know where that money comes from?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, yes. So the funding that is administered through the child care grant comes from the federal funding, and there's a set aside that's meant for quality. And so the funds that provide that come from those set aside dollars that are federal that are focused on quality.
Okay. No, thank you. I think, I'm fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just reading through the next section of going through this bill into section 34. Looking at child care facility and who might be eligible for these grants. This would also qualify for home child care centers that aren't family, you know, that's not your own child related to blood marriage. And so would we make sure that these grants and the items for quality would be eligible for those folks that may not have the other financial resources of some of the large daycare centers? You're nodding, but it'd be helpful if you can verbalize.
Yes, to Chair Wilson, for the record, Leah Van Kirk. So this funding supports licensed child care homes or child care centers. So yes, the child care grant supports all licensed facilities with a caveat that they accept children who are receiving a subsidy.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions to the bill maker of the amendment? Senator Dunbar.
Yeah, I just say I support this amendment. I think it's important for a variety of reasons that we try to maintain quality. And I appreciate that there is a concern about supply, but I think there are other ways to directly increase supply while improving quality. One of those was on the floor yesterday and unfortunately didn't pass. But we'll have more chances to do it, and I hope we do, and I hope we pass this as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tobin. No, I have, and if you had another statement or question, I'm just trying to formulate my question here. I guess it's not a question, it's just a concern, because I've seen so many fiscal notes go through the Department of Education on anything regs and the continual increase, and even though that this bill already has those regs, I'm just afraid that the price tag this bill is going to increase even more with this additional amendment. I hope it doesn't. I hope the department will just absorb it in the current notes that are already attached to this piece of legislation. But that was my only concern, just because it's one of the few departments that anytime you touch them, they want to add additional costs to defeat, even though they already are currently doing that work. So that's my only comment and wrap up, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just want to mention a few things about this particular amendment and to hopefully touch on a few things that the Department of Representation indicated. So when it says to be designated as a quality child care facility, there is no stipulation or definition of what that is. So I hear the department say that their first level of quality is that licensure. So this would recognize that as a licensed child care facility, you are meeting the department's expectation of quality to begin with. The second piece is that we know that the department is currently having these conversations now and also has been working with some of our early childhood organizations to develop the Alaska Seed Program, which really helps you build your levels of quality. So my hope is that through this amendment, the department, in consultation with those child care resources and referral agencies, may create some level of a recognition program. I'm thinking like a sticker that you can put on your door that says, we've met the first level. We've met and received our recognition for our second level of quality. We've met our stipulation for our third level of quality, so that we can really inspire and incentivize child care facilities to continue to go through all those different levels to receive a higher recognition of their quality child care. And I think that's a really excellent idea and way to incentivize continued professional development, continued providing great service, and to ensure that they are following our expectations when it comes to how they use the public dollar effectively. So I'm hopeful that there is nothing in this amendment that creates any additional burden, as I believe the department's already doing this work. I just want to ensure that that work is codified and help give them some additional tools to really encourage childcare providers to seek additional levels of quality standards. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 3, U.10? Seeing none, amendment number 3 passes, which brings us back before the main bill before us, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've distributed a legal memo that I received at 3 p.m. today, and so I unfortunately was unable. No, I'd like to talk to Ms. Van Kirk if possible about this.
Yes.
Because I have some questions. The legal memo made some assumptions, and I wanted to craft an amendment, but I didn't have time. I didn't get it until today. So my questions are: so one of the assumptions is actually, let me just ask it this way: does this bill, there's a $6 million fiscal note from the department, does this bill just have tax credits, or does it increase the amount of direct subsidy through the grant program?
For the record, Leah Van Kirk, through the chair to Senator Dunbar. This bill increases the amount of subsidies. However, I will say the current subsidy program that administers federal funds utilizes an indirect approach. And so the federal financial assistance is considered indirect because the eligibility is determined by the beneficiary and the beneficiary chooses that provider.
That's great. Can I also follow, Mr. Chair? Yes. That's really good knowledge, and I'm still learning about this stuff. The new program, as we expand it with state dollars, will it still take just that indirect approach, or will it have a more direct approach with providers?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, it would utilize the same mechanism, so the same approach that we're currently using.
Okay, that's good to know. Is there a change in fund source at all after if we pass this bill? Will this program now have state dollars in addition to federal dollars?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, currently federal funds support about $17 million in subsidies. And so the state general funds that are noted in the fiscal note would be in addition to that.
Okay. So we are now supplementing with state general funds this program, which I'm very much a support of, but it does change the color of the money, if you will. So if you look at the legal memo, unfortunately, it only talks about tax credits and says that tax credits are clearly constitutional because they've been found constitutional in a variety of ways. And we tried to express to the legal department that, no, this is more than just tax credits. This is also a direct subsidy and a new kind of direct subsidy because state funds. So that part of the legal memo doesn't really apply. So the other questions I have, Ms. Van Kirk, this grant, does it go, and sort of the nature of these child care facilities, do they provide education services? Like, is there any instruction that is done at these, or is it sort of just you're keeping your child safe for this time period?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, child care facilities operate through the licensing requirements, and so that's based on ensuring the health and safety and a quality environment. There is not an educational curriculum that is defined or required of child care facilities.
Though it is not required, does it happen? Is there instruction? Is there early childhood education at these facilities, any of them?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, early childhood education is less formal than maybe a curriculum that's in front of someone. So in early childhood education, you may be working with a child through having blocks out and providing large motor opportunities. And so there's absolutely learning that occurs in childcare facilities and programs. Children learn through play, and that's an important approach that childcare facilities support through creating environments that are stimulating to children, that help them learn and grow. Certainly a goal of early childhood education is to provide children with the tools that they need to be ready for school. And so I would be remiss if I didn't say learning doesn't happen in childcare facilities, because it absolutely does. And early childhood education looks different than what a formal curriculum might look like in an educational institution. They are not identified as educational institutions, nor are they regulated by the Department of Education and Early Development.
That's a great point, and that's flagged in the legal memo that they are. I mean, it's sort of interesting. Basically say they're preschools, so they're not schools. They are not educational institutions. But my understanding, and Grant, I'm not on the task force, and so I'm not part of these discussions quite to the same level of depth, but in my work in the Anchorage Assembly even, it seems like that actually is kind of the direction people are trying to go, is making this more of an educational institution, more education that happens early on, or preparing for school, like you said, with instruction of some kind. And the childcare provider I met with a couple of days ago used a curriculum called Frog. It apparently is a national one. I looked it up. It had the word frog in it. Anyway, so it seems like we are trying to encourage early childhood education and are trying to encourage more instruction, not just warehousing of children. I mean, would you say that's an accurate representation of what we're trying to accomplish?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I think we're trying to accomplish ensuring that we provide an environment for children that is healthy, that is safe, that is helping with their support their ages and stages of child development. which is an important foundation to learning and to school. Certainly, there's not any educational requirements as part of child care licensing or child care centers.
Okay, great. I'm done with my questions, Mr. Chair, but I...
No, that's fine. I had a question for you, Senator Dunbar. Are you mostly referring to like maybe more pre-K than just child care? Child care goes from basically infancy on up to up. So there might be a difference between what I think you're more referencing is more of a pre-K type of situation, which I think some school districts do allow for versus just open child care.
Well, I guess I'll ask about the grant. What I thought it was up till 12. What's the age range we're talking about with these?
Sure. Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, the age range for child care is 0 to 12.
So I have a legal memo in front. I had raised the issue of the constitutionality of funding religious schools through this program. We have a very clear prohibition on religious schools in our funding, using public dollars for religious schools in our constitution, and it's much stronger than the federal prohibition. And so now we're going from federal to state dollars, so we're implicating that. And a tax credit, clearly the legal analysis here shows tax credit is still constitutional, but we're not just using a tax credit; we're using a subsidy, a direct subsidy, and. I think that a lot of what these religious organizations can clearly do child care, there's no question, and religious institutions can do child care, no question, non-constitutional. What I'm concerned about is public dollars going specifically to religious instruction, you know, religious classrooms, essentially. And I did a little bit of research and talked to a few people, and my understanding is that actually does happen in some of these providers. Now, most providers not. Most providers are just maybe the religion informs their values and informs the program, and that is obviously constitutional to me. But if you're actually providing religious instruction using state dollars in a school-like setting, something like literally physically in a school, it seems to me like we are implicating a portion of the U.S. state constitution. So I want to do an amendment. I don't have the time to do it, but I guess I would ask you, if we were to do an amendment that said grant funding from this program, say a section K in under 071 that said grant funding from this program may not be used for religious instruction, what kind of impact do you think that would have on your providers, if any? Because it sounds like that most of them don't do this.
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, I may need to reach out to some of our supports in order to answer your question.
Okay.
I just want to caveat, you know, I am not a lawyer or trained, and so I think, you know, I can speak to federally how the federal subsidy system is allowable, that it would operate aligned with the federal subsidy system. Continues to be an indirect expense where the parent or the beneficiary of that benefit chooses the provider. And I can speak to, you know, that child care licensing and the Department of Health is the regulatory body rather than the Department of Education. So I apologize if I can't speak directly to the legal component that you're asking about, but certainly could come back with more information if that would be helpful.
May I ask what brief follow-up?
Brief follow-up, Sarah Bigiesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love that kind of information. I want to be very specific about what I'm asking. I am not saying that religious organizations can't provide child care. I'm not saying that religious organizations can't provide education in general. What I'm saying is if you have religious instructions, ministry, some might call it, I don't think it is constitutional. Or I guess I'm curious what the department's view is of whether that is constitutional to fund. And perhaps it is the Department of Law and not the Department of Childhood.
Senator Gisel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I'm the only person of this five-person committee who has actually raised children, which I have, three of them, and interacted with child care home homes that provide childcare as a volunteer for a foster care organization and transporting children to and from appointments with their birth parents. You know, to say that a childcare facility, to question whether it's an educational facility or not, children go through developmental milestones. And even if it's an infant, that infant's developmental milestone is trust. Knowing that the people around them will care for them and that they can interact safely, that's teaching. That's helping a child reach that milestone. For toddlers, setting limits. You're teaching them what the limits are and helping them achieve a milestone. I also think about families from various ethnicities who that ethnicity has religious beliefs. You know, parents will choose that type of home to go to because of that cultural commonality. When you choose a childcare facility, you are looking for a substitute for yourself as a parent. Will this, you know, we talk about quality childcare and affordability and academic terms, but what parents are looking for is a substitute for themselves that will nurture this child, help them reach those milestones while the parent is at work, right? And also cultivate the cultural pieces that family has. So I would suggest that the department, I'm directing it to Ms. Van Kirk, consider those kinds of things as you write regulations and the laws that we set around education. Is it an education facility? Is it a religious organization? We got to be careful here because families are choosing a substitute for themselves, and they need to be free to choose that correct substitute and still be eligible for the financial support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there any further questions for the bill sponsor? I know we're at time. I'm looking for the will of the committee. Senator Kaufman.
I have a motion. I move HB 89 version 33-LS0518/U as an upside down, as amended, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 89 as amended moves from committee. We just ask members to stick around to sign the document on Tuesday, April 16th. Is our next committee meeting where we'll take back up HB 17, contraceptive coverage, insured medical assist by, and we will also hear our first hearing on SB 219, prior authorization for healthcare providers. With that, is there any closing members' comments? We are adjourned at 5:04 p.m.